Good morning. You are listening to People Rise Up on KBOO, your non-commercial community radio station. My name's Andrew Geller, and I'd just like to thank everyone at the front end for a successful membership drive, everyone who pledged any time during the drive, specifically this program. And remember, we expect the money that you pledge to actually show up. So pay your pledge. If you got a bill in the mail, send it in as soon as you can. And thanks to everyone for all their assistance during membership drive. I'm going to sort of dovetail with the show last week, speaking about the corporate threat to family farms globally, and talk a little bit about farming here in the United States, and specifically the Mississippi River Basin. Many of you have probably heard about something called a dead zone that occurs in the Gulf of Mexico annually. And there's other spots around the world as well. And the Environmental Working Group has produced a report that looks at the Gulf Coast dead zone and agriculture payments to promote fertilizer use during spring planting across the Mississippi River Basin. Mary Booth is a senior scientist with the Environmental Working Group and was lead author on this report called Dead in the Water, and I'm very pleased to have you with us. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, the Gulf Coast dead zone is not exactly a new phenomena. In fact, in reading through the report and a little bit of the supporting material you have, it's actually one of these environmental problems that pretty much everyone who looks at it agrees what the problem is, which is sort of unusual. Tell us a little bit about the work that led to this report, in that this report is sort of a follow-up and a later assessment of initial work done studying the Gulf Coast.
Right. Well, the government back in the late 90s decided that the dead zone was a topic worth investigating and commissioned a bunch of different federal agencies to put together a working group and produce a multi-volume study on this problem, where one of the products of that assessment was a model which characterized the different inputs of nitrogen into the water, because the dead zone is basically caused by nutrients flowing down the river and causing these massive algal blooms, which then decompose and die when they die, and that process consumes oxygen out of the water, which makes it unlivable for marine life. So this model that was part of the government's assessment, along with many other studies that had been conducted, came to the conclusion that the majority of that nitrogen pollution that's flowing down the river is from non-point runoff from farm fields. So, as you said, I mean, there is just basically tremendous consensus on the causes of this problem. And, in fact, even the Fertilizer Institute, unbelievably, has finally admitted that maybe non-point runoff of fertilizer is contributing to hypoxia in the Gulf. And that's the technical term, is hypoxia, which means the absence of oxygen.
Yeah, and the threshold that you folks have in your report is 2 parts per million oxygen. That seems extraordinarily low. I'm curious what level of oxygen in water is sort of a minimum to support life.
Well, that's probably the minimum.
Really, two parts per million.
More typically, well-oxygenated waters are around 10 parts per million.
Okay.
And as the concentrations fall, different groups of organisms start dropping out.
Okay.
And basically, the more the creatures that can swim can often sense the low oxygen conditions, and they flee the area, and that leads to this phenomenon known in the Gulf area as a jubilee, which is a wave of fish swimming away from the low oxygen zone, and when they swim in toward shore and they're forced in toward shore, that can actually make for great fishing conditions for people. You get out there with a net practically and scoop them out of the water because they're all being bunched up against the shore.
Now, you threw a term out here that I just wanted to explain a little bit for folks who weren't familiar with it, non-point source. In, I suppose, air pollution and land pollution as well, it could be used, but it's mostly associated with water pollution. And basically, there's point sources of pollution where you can say, this is where it's coming from. And then the idea of non-point source is it's so broadly distributed in terms of its source that it's, I mean, you can say, well, yeah, it's farms, but it's so pervasive that you can't necessarily say, this is it right here exactly.
Yeah, that's correct. And the thing, typically, point sources are associated with things that come out the end of a pipe, usually.
Mm-hmm.
Although some concentrated animal feeding operations are actually regulated under the Clean Water Act as point sources because it's a discrete area where maybe manure is being concentrated and that acts as a point source into rivers and streams. But in general, when we're talking about non-point sources, we're talking about any kind of pollution that's on the land that is conveyed into rivers and streams with drainage, basically. So if it rains, that stuff gets mobilized and conveyed into rivers and streams.
Now, this dead zone covers an area that ranges pretty much between about 6,000 square miles and 8,000 square miles. I guess that was the peak, 8,000 in 2002. That's about the size of Connecticut or New Jersey. It's been, as we mentioned, it's been known for quite some time the cause of this, and the levels of nitrogen fertilizer have been increasing for quite some time. They've gone up about 15% in the past 15 or so years. And you folks find that during the peak spring fertilization season, which also happens to coincide with very heavy precipitation in the planting zone, 7.8 million pounds of fertilizer nitrate per day go into the Gulf of Mexico. That works out to 80 tons of fertilizer during the course of this program, which I found staggering. It's about 2.5 tons a minute.
It's an incredible number. Actually, just to refine what you said just now just a little bit, our work, there hasn't been actually, there's been a somewhat of an increase in fertilizer use over that time period that we did the report for, which was 1990 to 2002, which was when we had the good data for. But the major increase in fertilizer use actually predates that considerably. Starting from the
50s and 60s,
yeah, the 50s and 60s onward, and the real shift in the kind of the nitrogen signal coming down the river, which is the kind of nitrogen that's coming down. There's different kinds of nitrogen, but the kind that we associate with this fertilizer runoff is nitrate, and the big increase in nitrate, and the big increase in nitrate, particularly in the spring, that's associated with fertilizer runoff, started around the 70s and has been increasing since then.
Now, is the, what's the reason for that? Is it because the increase during the 50s and 60s made, you know, it either depleted the soil through the consistent application, or did plants in some manner change to the point they needed more fertilizer to grow? Because of the varieties they're growing?
Well, we've put more and more land under cultivation, actually. So the increase in actually farmed acres was substantial.
Okay.
And also a shift toward, you know, away from relying on some of the traditional ways that plants were grown, which was relying on the nutrients that are just naturally in the soil, and also using kind of cover cropping and alternating crops with plants that actually fix atmospheric nitrogen into biologically available forms. Before the intense use of chemical fertilizers that we have now, farmers relied on some of those ways of getting nutrients for the plants. But with the intensification of agriculture and the depletion of the native soil nitrogen that's already in the soil, that goes into the plant, and then the plant is harvested and carried away. And you have to replace the nitrogen that's in the soil. And that's why we rely so heavily on these what we call inorganic fertilizers now. And those are just practically an inevitable consequence. We have to use those now for the way that we farm. But what our report is showing is that this non-point runoff from the excessive use of these nitrogen fertilizers needs to be controlled, and that we actually probably can control it and achieve significant improvements in water quality and also reduce the size of the dead zone if we concentrate on these hot spots of the Mississippi River Basin where crops are grown intensively and there's a lot of non-point runoff. And so if we concentrate our conservation efforts and work toward achieving a more sustainable kind of farming in those areas, then we can actually realize some real gains in water quality.
Yeah, because as you folks find, about 15% of the total land area of the Mississippi River Basin is actually responsible for about 80% of the spring surge in nitrate runoff. And these are primarily concentrated in eastern Iowa. Looks like about the eastern third of the state is the heaviest. Just about the entire state of Illinois, and that was really sort of amazing to see, and kind of the northwestern and sort of western edge of Ohio, as well as a couple spots in Arkansas and Missouri. Now, what is planted there? I'm not from there. I've never really spent a whole lot of time in the Midwest.
Right. Well, there's an awful lot of corn being grown in those areas and alternating sometimes with soybeans or just monocropping corn or monocropping soybeans. It kind of depends on where you are. But those are the big fertilizer input crops. And then as you go further south, below Missouri, down into Arkansas, there's quite a bit of rice being grown as well. And the thing about those agricultural areas is that some of them are normally too wet to farm, and so they're artificially drained. There's a thing called tile drainage where farmers actually install these pipes underneath the soils to take water out of the fields quickly to allow the plants to grow better. And that leads to even more fertilizer runoff than would happen if those fields weren't being artificially drained. So that's compounding the problem as well. But yeah, the Illinois is really a huge source of this problem. And the other interesting thing, of course, from our report is that these areas are getting such high amounts of commodity support payments, typical farm subsidies.
You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO in Portland, Oregon. My guest is Mary Booth. She's a senior scientist with the Environmental Working Group, and we're discussing their report in which she was lead author, Dead in the Water, that talks about the Gulf Coast Dead Zone and its upstream sources in the Mississippi River Basin. You can find out more about this report and other work of theirs at www.ewg.org and the People Rise Up website, available at kboo.fm, has links to their report, their page, and other resources about hypoxia and dead zones. Now, it's not only those three states that contribute to this problem, or actually those five states, but the northern part, Iowa, Illinois, Indiana, are definitely the largest area. And you folks have, and I don't know that this has been done before in reading other materials about this, you actually track nitrogen runoff to federal subsidized commodity payment programs for, I imagine it's mostly for corn and soy, and wheat was mentioned a little bit, and as you mentioned, rice. Now, I'm imagining these payments are from the farm bill that comes up every, 5 or 7 years?
That's correct.
Okay, and these are also issues that the United States is trying to defend in terms of subsidized agriculture at the World Trade Organization as well.
Absolutely. And okay. Commodity subsidies paying farmers for what they produce and the consequences of that, which is that very often we pay farmers to actually overproduce crops, drives commodity prices down on the market. And we flood the market internationally with very cheaply produced subsidized crops, which is very much in contention in under the WTO rulings. So one thing about the subsidy system is that conservation payments, which are also funded with federal subsidies, those are payments that go to farmers to either take land out of production or to help farmers grow crops in ways that are more sustainable and that don't lead to so much runoff, that ways that help them protect water supplies. Those kinds of payments are not considered to be controversial under the WTO rules. And so by shifting more money from traditional commodity subsidies into conservation payments, we can not only improve the water situation, but we can also bring our farm policy more into compliance with international norms.
Now, some of the ratio in spending is pretty amazing. You have specific counties. There's a couple counties listed on your webpage, Livingston County in Illinois and Champaign County in Illinois, where the ratio of spending on commodity payments to conservation payments is over 2,000 to 1. That's really astounding.
Well, those are conservation payments that were actually directed toward improving the situation with water quality. So those are the kinds of conservation payments that are given to farmers to be used on working lands, and did not include that list did not include money that was given to farmers just for conservation reserve payments that are designed to just take land out of production. So if you include the conservation reserve monies, that those ratios do improve a little bit, but the Conservation Reserve Program was not designed to be a water quality improvement program. It was actually originally designed to take highly erodible lands out of production. And actually, I was looking before the show, I looked up on our farm subsidy database, which is available and searchable to anybody on our website. I looked up the distribution of payments for Oregon, and actually Oregon's a big recipient of conservation reserve money because probably, in the dry eastern part of the state, that there's probably quite a few areas that have been taken out of production there to protect those soils.
That wouldn't be surprising at all, and even potentially down south in some years in the Klamath Basin. Now, you folks note that the issue of the conservation payments being so low is really a federal government restriction of funds from the federal government, and not that farmers don't want money to do projects in these areas.
Absolutely. There are programs on the books already, the Wetlands Reserve Program, the Environmental Quality Incentive Program, a sub-program of the CRP called the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program, which is designed to help farmers, again, with working lands. All of these are working lands programs. They're on the books. They're proven. They're great programs. And they're being significantly underfunded. Our research showed that in 2004, over 68,000 farmers applied to receive money under these programs and were turned away because there weren't enough funds. But meanwhile, commodity payments, no one's ever turned away for commodity payments.
Right.
You see a lot of variation year to year in commodity payments for that period that we looked at. We looked at the payments from 1995 to 2002. There's a three-year period there from 1999 to 2001 where commodity payments in the Mississippi River Basin averaged over $13 billion a year. Which was a 260% increase over the previous three-year period. But at the same time, conservation payments kind of tick along at the same level every year. The funding level for those has been about just over $1 billion in the Mississippi River Basin a year, every year since those programs were instituted.
Now, it seems kind of obvious that if things continue to operate as they have, the dead zone will likely increase in size and occasionally set new records, and things will just sort of gradually worsen in the Gulf. It seems like it would be really easy to have, it'd be really, really easy to have a small impact. It'd be fairly easy. I mean, 15% of the land, 80% of the runoff. That's a really good opportunity there. Is there support? I mean, this is kind of like changing farming practice and reforming the subsidization in the agriculture program. So it's targeting the Congress and the Department of Agriculture. Are there sympathetic Congress people in these states for this funding, or is it just kind of below the radar for them and they focus on the commodity payment to make sure farmers are paid?
I think it's a little of both. I mean, there are definitely people in Congress who are sympathetic to this argument. And, you know, people care about water quality. And, you know, so there is definitely support. But at the same time, the farm lobby is incredibly powerful. And, you know, conservation groups can wave their arms around all they want, but the farm lobby is always going to be the one with the fatter checkbook. So we really hope that in this upcoming farm bill that this report will help focus people's minds on this problem and also on how fixable it really could be if we make some strategic shifts in funding. And another component to that that we feel should happen eventually is that we should require that farmers show conservation compliance, that they actually submit a nutrient management plan as a condition for receiving federal subsidies. I mean, we're giving a lot of money to farmers to basically farm in a way that's not sustainable, and we're losing local water quality, we're losing local wetlands, we're losing all these things all up and down the Mississippi River Basin. And then, of course, ultimately, all that pollution ends up in the Gulf, and we're wiping out that fishery. And as if the Gulf hadn't already suffered enough in the wake of the hurricanes, it seems like an urgent priority to get things back on track.
And it also costs the farmers a lot of money. I mean, the fertilizer that's getting washed away, it's not like they don't pay for it.
Right. Well, our research showed that on average, $270 million worth of fertilizer was going down the river every year for that period of 1990 through 2002. And if you take today's fertilizer prices, which are considerably higher because it takes a lot of energy, it actually takes natural gas to make fertilizer. And fertilizer prices have really increased in the last year or so because of the cost of energy. And if you use today's fertilizer prices and look at what's being lost down into the Gulf, it's almost $400 million just in the spring alone.
Do you think that it could just ultimately end up as an economic issue in that farmers will not be able to purchase fertilizer that could ultimately reduce this nutrient loading?
Well, fertilizer costs are a significant component of a farmer's net cost, for sure. And, you know, the Fertilizer Institute and other large entities like that always argue that farmers would never use a pound more fertilizer than they need because it is expensive. But we don't see any evidence that the cost of fertilizer is really driving any kind of great change. People tend to farm the way they've always farmed, and we know there's basically this runoff problem has existed for a long time. It's going to continue to exist unless we start doing something to kind of rebuild what we like to call the ecological infrastructure around that would consist of restoring wetlands, building new wetlands, restoring buffer zones around streams, all these things that will help intercept nitrogen runoff before it gets into rivers and streams. And it just seems like a common sense thing to restore these landscapes to their original function, really.
Has there been effort that you know of to organize amongst the affected fisher people to advocate for, you know, solving a problem that they have by working with farmers upstream?
Well, I think definitely the Gulf fishery, among all its other problems right now, maybe half the fishing boats being 4 miles inland could be a big part of that. But they definitely have suffered, and they definitely are aware of this problem. As far as getting together and organizing to lobby farmers upstream, I mean, this is a really tough problem to solve because of the great geographic distance between where the problem originates and who's actually suffering from it. And I don't think there's been any coordinated effort on the part of the fishery to reach out to farmers, but they would be forgiven for believing that the government was on the problem. I mean, after all, the government did put together the hypoxia assessment team, and they came out with those great reports and those great recommendations, but nothing's really changed. So hopefully that will begin to change. There is a meeting in New Orleans next week to readdress the problem that's being run by EPA, and with the upcoming Farm Bill, we'll have some new opportunities to make improvements.
And when is that Farm Bill going to be? I thought there was a Farm Bill at some point during the Bush administration already.
Yeah, well, it's going to be sometime in 2007, I think. So.
Okay. All right, well, great. Mary Booth is a senior scientist with the Environmental Working Group. She's lead author of their recent report, Dead in the Water, that looks at the Gulf Coast Dead Zone and its upstream causes. You can find out more about them online at www.ewg.org. Thank you very much for joining us this morning, Mary.
Thank you, Andrew.
Take care.
Bye.
And the People Rise Up website at kboo.fm. also has links to the Environmental Working Group report, Dead in the Water, as well as some other resources about hypoxia and dead zones. Thanks very much for listening to the program. If you got questions or comments or other feedback, you can send email to me at kboo@riseup.net. You can send regular letter mail to me here, postal mail, at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Again, thanks to everyone who pledged during the recent membership drive, and please do pay your pledge. After a brief message, we will have Making Contact, continuing on an agricultural theme this morning.
Are you under 21 and interested in making radio? Come down to KBOO and join our youth collective.
We plan our shows, The Underground, a public affairs show which airs the fourth Wednesday of every month from 6 to 7.
And the Youth Randomonian, which is on the last Friday of every month from 11 to midnight.
We play music and other youth performers on this show.
The Youth Collective meets every Wednesday at 6 p.m.
at 20th Southeast 8th Avenue for about an hour.
If you want more information, call Aaron Yankee, the KBOO Youth Advocate, at 503-231-8032, extension 511.
Or email kboo youth@hotmail.com.